Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. David Peretz. David Peretz has a PhD in politics from Oxford University, where he was a Marshall Scholar. He is a professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence College and a frequent lecturer at the Fromm Institute at the University of California, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at San Francisco State University, and at various other lifelong learning and community venues in the San Francisco Bay and New York City areas. His research focuses on contemporary democratic theory, theories of justice, and social conditions of diversity, inequality, and interconnection. He is currently engaged in a research projects on how democratic polities maintain and repair themselves. Dr. Peretz.
All right. Thank you. So it's wonderful to be back at the Commonwealth Club. And I just want to start by thanking Bill and Carol for organizing what I think is an incredibly timely and important forum, and thank all of you for being here. Civil discourse is precious, and the Commonwealth Club sustains civil discourse. And so that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, but we're also going to be instantiating it. I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground. Apologies to any of you who were intent on coming to two talks. We got a little over our skis. It turns out we can only do one talk per session. I'm going to try to cover a number of themes that I would have covered had we been together for two consecutive Tuesday evenings. And I'm going to start out by talking about an original research project that I'm in the middle of, and that's a research project on democratic self-maintenance and self-repair. And this comes out of a sense of the urgency of restoring public agency over American democracy. For those of you who heard me speak last summer, you know that I'm concerned about a crisis of responsiveness on the part of our elected officials, who can be, I think, really conclusively demonstrated to not respond at all to what about 90% of the American population wants them to do, and also a broader crisis of responsiveness, I think, in which many of us feel that we have no meaningful input into the terms of political discourse in our society as those are carried by the public sphere. And so part of my question is, when things go wrong with democracies, how do democracies repair themselves? That's the big question. And I want to start with the general idea that democracy in general and 21st century democracy in particular must secure its own social and cultural and institutional preconditions. The Greeks used to think you could bring somebody in from outside to help you, a tyrant who would set things right. That's not the kind of society that we live in. If democracy is decaying, it's up to the citizens of a democracy to repair and restore it. And so how do we go about this business? And I'll just note that when our founders put the Constitution together and amended it in the first session of Congress, they created a First Amendment because they knew a free press was vital to democracy. And they subsidized the circulation of newspapers in the post office because they wanted to support vital exchanges of public opinion in a print literature. But that's all they did. They assumed, in a sense, that the citizens could meet those opportunities halfway, and that as a result, all they needed to do was create the opportunity. And it seems to me one of the big things we should be thinking about is whether that assumption still holds, or whether in the 21st century we as citizens need to be thinking a little bit more about how we actually curate the preconditions for democracy. And so that's the big semi-ambitious research project I'm working on right now. And I want to point out some of the background assumptions in the literature I'm looking at, and that is that in modern conditions, this doesn't happen all the time. That is to say, we get busy. We have jobs. We have love lives. We like movies and our handhelds and going to religious organizations. And so it's not the case that democratic citizens are constantly vigilant about maintaining democracy. As opposed to that, we are intermittently mobilized to re-secure the conditions for democracy. And in the periods in which we're not, we go through periods of democratic complacency or inertia in which we do less to maintain democracy. And often in those periods, our institutions end up adrift and sometimes captured by powerful social elites. So the standard model, if you will, is one of alternation or pendulum swings in which we go through periods of demobilization and periods of remobilization. And it's during those periods of remobilization that citizens reclaim control over democracy. And I'm interested in particular in how that works. And my big idea here is that it works by resetting the terms of political discourse. And this is an informal cultural idea. What is normatively appropriate for politicians to say, to think, to do? What are the bounds that we as citizens want them to respect? And so I can think here of the kinds of transformations that occurred in our lifetimes, for instance, around environmentalism, right? When I was born, that was still a kooky idea. It almost disqualified you from being a serious political figure, right? And at this point, I think it's almost disqualifying to be completely indifferent to the environment, right? That doesn't mean that we all agree. Obviously, we don't agree on issues like global climate change, and that may be disastrous that we can't come to an agreement on that. But at least we agree that it's one of the responsibilities of our political elite and of our political process to secure environmental health for all of us. And that's one example of how, when citizens mobilize, they can change the terms that structure the game of politics. So a way of thinking of this is that the rules of the game themselves get changed. All right. So on the handout, and I guess I'm going to have to ask you to envision this, I have a continuum of dysfunctional forms of democracy. And I'm kind of playing with ideas here. The first least dysfunctional form of democracy is diminished democracy. That's a relatively well-known book by Theodore Scotchpole written in 2003. A still more dysfunctional form, further along the spectrum, would be perhaps Disfigured Democracy, a book from 2014. And I'll talk a little bit more about these ideas, but a still more dysfunctional form of democracy, and some of you may be familiar with this work, would be Dying Democracy, right? And so one of the ideas here is that the longer we wait to undertake the work of democratic repair, the further we get along that spectrum of democratic dysfunction, and the more difficult it is to engage in democratic repair. And I will just tell you that I think these titles are not accidental. They're arrayed historically. We've gone from diminished to disfigured democracy. And there are a lot of people in my field writing right now about whether or not we may be not in a pendulum swing in which we've gone to a period in which maybe we'll be remobilizing and reasserting public agency over the terms of public discourse, but instead, maybe we're in a democratic death spin, right? That our institutions are too atrophied, that our channels of accountability are too non-responsive, that our media is too fractured, that our civil discourse is too coarse and polarized and fragmented for us to collectively do the work of democratic repair that is essential to be done on an intermittent basis on a democratic society. And so that's a first thesis that's guiding my work. The further along the spectrum of dysfunction you are, the more difficult democratic repair is, and yet the more urgent the project of democratic repair becomes. A second thesis is that democratic repair requires broad-based popular mobilization, organized into powerful movements, and that those social movements undertake the work of, as may be required, either restoring or revising the terms of political discourse, the rules of the game, saying, for instance, as the hashtag MeToo movement is saying right now, it's no longer acceptable that workplaces be a place of sexual vulnerability for women, right? That's going to become part of the political discourse, and that requires broad-based mobilization. But broad-based mobilization requires two things at least. One is a sense of popular empowerment. We can actually do this. We can use our civil discourse and our political institutions to change the workplace. And it also requires a sense that we can work together, right? That we're not so fractured and segmented that we're always going to fall apart on issues like these as opposed to coming together. And my suggestion then is that this is what democratic self-repair requires, but obviously the further you are along that spectrum of democratic dysfunction, the more difficult it becomes to envision having the power and the unity to do the work of democratic self-repair. Third thesis, and this is going to, in a sense, be the focus point for the remainder of this talk, there are potential trade-offs in moments like this where we urgently need to do the work of democratic self-repair between expressing outrage at what is currently dysfunctional, and especially at policies pursued by fellow citizens on the one hand, and on the other hand, building the kind of a broad-based mobilization democratic self-repair requires, right? And so that's why we talk about a death spiral. If at some point we get so distressed and agitated with what's going wrong with democracy that we can no longer envision doing anything but fighting the fight that's right in front of us, we lose track of the urgent issue of also undertaking democratic self-repair. I'll just add, everything I've said right up till this point has been highly general. This is especially the case in the United States, where our political institutions are designed to diffuse and check power, and where it's very difficult to get anything meaningful done without some bipartisan cooperation. And so in a sense, the label I haven't used yet that could describe everything I'm talking about is polarization, and especially partisan polarization. And partisan polarization is particularly destructive given the 18th century constitutional machinery that our politicians have to navigate to get anything done, right? And so the concluding thought then is that we need to think about the relative urgency of the issues that we face. Are we more concerned with winning the battle in front of us today on the policy agenda, or should we be more concerned with democratic self-repair? And even if you're not convinced that democratic self-repair is the most urgent issue, if you're convinced that it's an urgent issue, how might that moderate or modify our day-to-day stances on ordinary policy and partisan issues? All right. So now I want to talk with you about polarization and the decline of civil democratic discourse in early 21st century America, and what, if anything, we can do about it. And I want to start out by pointing out to you two things. The first is that I am not a political scientist. Appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, I am a political theorist or a political philosopher. I do not have the technical training that political scientists have. And so I have parachuted into this literature to try to get some impressions of what's going on in American politics, but this is not my milieu. This is not my specialty. And so take everything I say drawn from political science, please, with a grain of salt. I certainly stand to be corrected. First thing now I want to point out is that we are in an era of polarization, but that this is, and this is absolutely clear in terms of if you look at the amount of bipartisan work that's going on in Congress, for instance, it's at its lowest point since the Civil War. If you look at the degree of the partisan divide on the Supreme Court, it's at its highest point since the Civil War, right? There are obvious signs that we are in an era of partisan polarization. The controversy in the scholarly literature has been around the question of whether or not we, the people, are as polarized as our leaders and media are. But I think the literature is moving in the direction of saying, yes, in many respects, we are, in fact, as polarized. But it's not symmetrical polarization. And there are two things to note. First, if by polarization we mean ideological polarization, the Democrats have moved to the left, the Republicans have moved to the right, that is not what has happened, at least until quite recently. Over the last 30 years, the Republicans have moved quite far to the right, objectively measured, and the Democrats have moved a little bit to the right. Right. And so the polarization that we're experiencing, and this is I can't go into the methodology, but using objective criteria to measure party policy issues, the Republicans from mid-1970s to the present have moved quite far to the right. Over that same time period, Democrats have moved a little bit to the right. The result is that they're further apart than they were before, but it's not because they're moving in opposite directions. Second of all, if you start talking about people as opposed to parties, you will see also that this is a little bit of a funky way of looking at things, but what this is looking at not leaders, but everyday people's degree of partisan antipathy, right? How much do you disagree with the other party? And again, what you can see here is that from the 1960s to the present, it has been increasing. And by the way, when you see those spikes in both parties, that means that the other party has a president usually, right? That's when you really disagree with the other party. But having said that, you can also see that the Republicans started out with more of a sense of antipathy to Democrats, and that has gone up quite significantly over this 40-ish year period, 50-ish year period. And on the other hand, the Democrats actually started out kind of neutral about Republicans, and that might have been easier because they were in power most of this time. But it's only recently that the Democrats are really defining themselves antithetically against Republicans and not nearly as much as Republicans define themselves against Democrats. So asymmetrical polarization. Now, second thing, and again, this is a little technical, what I'm trying to demonstrate here, and I'm drawing on the work now of a very interesting young political scientist named Ileana Mason, who has the wonderfully titled work "I Disrespectfully Agree," and what she points out in her work is when you look at the strong partisanship, and this is no longer separating Democrats and Republicans, this is putting everyone together and sorting. How much do you feel like your party is where you belong, right? They have both increased quite markedly over the last 40 years, whereas the percentage of people who define themselves as genuinely independent has gone down. Now look at this. That is on issues. And I think what you see is that actually we have not become polarized on issues, right? We define ourselves against each other and in terms of our partisan identities, when in fact we also agree on a large number of issues if you go issue by issue. And so part of the question, right, the title, "I Disrespectfully Agree," is which do you consider to be more important, your issue stance or your partisan identity? And part of what's happened in America over the last 40, 50 years is that we focus more on our partisan identity than on our issue position, right? And so that's a little bit about the nature of polarization. Now, I want to talk about evidence of the deterioration of political discourse in particular, right? And this is something I think more precise and more focused. Can we still talk to each other across partisan lines? And here, my claim is that there's a lot that's going wrong in civil society in America. And so I'm just going to tick off a few points here. The first is to still talk about the parties, but what it's doing to the rest of us. And this is the erosion of partisan elites' norms that made bipartisan cooperation possible. Right. And here I'm looking at the work of Levitsky and Ziblatt in that book, How Democracies Die. And they suggest that norms of mutual toleration, mutual respect would be even better. Right. But at least mutual toleration. The parties recognize each other as legitimate and forbearance. They don't play a no holds barred competitive game, but instead they play by the rules. They seek to win, but they don't try to alter the rules in order to win. That those norms have declined. And again, I'm really not trying to beat up on Republicans here. I do think that the evidence here is objective. Levitsky and Ziblatt suggest that it's the Republican Party that has initiated change and changed more dramatically, and they are concerned that it's moving in the direction of being an anti-system party, a party that actually doesn't trust the system that structures democratic competition in the society in which they live. The Democrats, by the way, have reciprocated, but not as strongly at the level of partisan elites. Growth of negative partisanship, and I didn't collect data on these points, but I'll just point out to you, there's a lot of interesting research being done, especially out of Stanford by political psychologists, that show more and more people are motivated by their dislike of, anger for, or fear about the other party than they are by enthusiasm for their own party. And so if you look at this graphically, those two things have traded places when you look at people's political motivations. 50 years ago, we were more motivated positively. Now we are primarily motivated negatively, or by what's called negative partisanship. Rapid growth in social intolerance and anti-democratic attitudes. And here I'm getting into the more troubling stuff. There's a lot of research that shows that increasingly the norms that promoted especially racial and ethnic, but also religious tolerance are eroding among an important subset of almost exclusively white Americans, and that this is correlated with the same group withdrawing their support for democratic institutions. And interestingly, in this literature, the finding is that the better educated you are, the less likely you are to support democracy, because you have a better understanding that democratic institutions tend to afford protection to ethnic and religious and racial minorities. And if you no longer believe in tolerance, then you may withdraw support for the institutions that force you to be tolerant or prevent you from being intolerant. Continuing along these lines, again, work in political psychology shows that there's a great deal of resentment against norms of political conversational constraint. What do I mean here? I mean PC, politically correct, right? That you don't insult a ethnic group by comparing them to animals or questioning their humanity. And there's really interesting research being done, because most people won't admit this, right? That they resent those norms and that they wish they didn't have to subscribe to them. But there are ways in designing surveys and doing works in psychology labs that you can figure out whether or not, if they think nobody is looking or the test is completely anonymous or they're not really testing that issue, whether or not people resent having to be tolerant and politically correct. And there's a great deal of evidence that there's a great deal of resentment against that, and that recent years are legitimizing the removal of these kinds of conversational constraints that seem to be necessary as the United States becomes an increasingly multiracial democracy. More on that in a few minutes. Fifth and final point on these issues is that we have increased attention to core issues of civic membership and status. Who belongs in this country? Who doesn't belong in this country? Obviously around immigration, but it appears also increasingly around race. These issues, which in a sense I think many of us hoped that the civil rights movement had put to rest, appear to be reemerging in American politics, not just on the part of our leaders, but survey evidence suggests on the part of many Americans. All right, so now I want to present a little bit of evidence about when it is that people actually get together and talk across party lines, right? And what I'm suggesting is that this gets harder. There's a wonderful book I'll just throw this in real quick. That one of the correlations, this is not causation necessarily, is that as our society gets more unequal, it gets more polarized. The dotted line there is a measure of polarization. The solid line is a measure of inequality. And you can see the way in which the two go together. They may be reinforcing each other. The more polarized we become, the more difficult it is to enact policies that battle inequality. On the other hand, the more unequal we become, the more resentful we become of those who seem to be monopolizing or hoarding opportunity in our society. But here's where I want to focus for a minute. And this is some very interesting work by Diana Muntz, a book called Hearing the Other Side. And she studies how cross-party conversation works. And as you can see, I don't have a pointer, but I hope you can see that there are two lines here. One line looks at the effects among respondents without civil orientation to conflict, right? These are people who are motivated by partisan antipathy, right? And so they're not interested in having a conversation with somebody who disagrees with them. They just want to make their point. And as you can see, what she's measuring is how much you understand about the other side. And if you have an uncivil orientation, you can interact a lot with the other side and not learn very much, right? Whereas when people interact with people with whom they differ and they have a civil orientation to conflict, you need to be polite. You need to listen. You need to hear out the other side. You need to treat them with respect. Then people actually learn a lot from their encounter with difference. And so that's part of, I think, what's concerning about the current circumstances is as civility declines, it becomes harder and harder to have productive cross-partisan dialogue. Now, I want to talk a little bit in terms of the specific research I do, and this is on public sphere and public discourse theory. How does the public sphere do the work of restoring democracy? And here the suggestion is that when we as citizens organize ourselves as a public, we are bringing into being a strange, fantastic, imaginary creature, the public, that has an opinion. And we're doing that in the medium of discourse itself. A public is created by the discourse that animates and sustains it, right? What is a public? It's not an institution. It's not an organization. It requires institutions and organizations, but it itself is the anonymous association of a whole bunch of strangers who consider themselves to be the addressees and potentially the initiators of public discourse, right? That's really what a public is. And part of the reason the public can be the sovereign and the public can do the work of repairing democracy when necessary is precisely because it isn't identified with the state. The public gets to repair the state when the state is dysfunctional, right? How does that work? Well, it's because we as a public are independent from and capable of engaging in discourse that is critical of the state. So we bring ourselves into being as a public by discussing things with each other, by listening to each other, by hearing public discourse, right? And I won't give you all the citations here, but there's a rich, fabulous literature on this stuff. At least it's a literature that I love reading. So the question is, how does this work and how is it breaking down in contemporary society? And I want to suggest a couple themes. One of them is that there's a dynamic tension between the general and the particular in any public. A public, it seems, by its very self-conception, is almost all-inclusive. Who isn't a member of a public, right? And here the idea is that anybody who pays attention, who is a citizen, who is capable of being addressed by public discourse, is a member of the public. And yet, a public, as I've been saying, is also an imaginary creation. And part of what that means is that we imagine it. And we have categories and ideas and institutions in mind. When you think of a public spokesperson, who or what kind of person do you think of? When you think of yourself making a public address, who do you think of yourself addressing? And maybe the better example here is not getting up and speaking to a small group of people, but writing a letter to the editor, right? You know, you can't really imagine the thousands or millions of people who are going to read that letter, but you have an image of what the public is like, who they're composed of, a style that you think is appropriate to them, right? And one of the things that this literature, and I'm drawing especially on Michael Warner here, who is very interesting on thinking about publics and counterpublics, that there's certain people who know in advance that they're not what most people think about when they think about the public, right? And this can be a disempowering, a disabling sensation, and it can also be a source of political protest. Why shouldn't you think of someone like me? And so the work I'm looking at looks at the way in which counterpublics have organized themselves to dispute the arbitrary limitation of the public, not legally, but in the imagination of citizens, right? And so just to be explicit about this, for many, many years, centuries, in fact, most Americans probably thought that the typical member of the public was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male straight person who owns some property, right? I mean, and I'm obviously being stereotyped, but I think that there's a lot to be said in that. And so people who wanted to expand the we and we the people needed to convince the public that its imagination was artificially constrained and limited, and that it needed to expand the people it addressed or imagined as it addressed or listened to public addresses. And I would suggest to you that over the last, let's call it, quarter century, we've moved quite far in the direction of having an expanded we in which racial minorities, women, people who are religious minorities or of a different sexual orientation have claimed more of a legitimate role in our political discourse. They may, in fact, have moved from being counterpublics to being one of the ways in which we imagine who we discuss things with when we discuss things in public. But I think this has been quite threatening to a large number of Americans, and it is those people who thought of themselves as the center of political discourse who are being decentered, right? They're no longer the person you think of if you think of Barack Obama as your president, or Hillary Clinton as your Secretary of State, et cetera, and so on, right? And so I'm going to share a quite gross example with you for a moment. It's an example from ancient Greek history. Diogenes, a Greek philosopher, when he felt a sexual urge, would walk into the marketplace and masturbate. I kid you not. Why would he do this? He was challenging the boundaries of the public. Masturbation, that's sexuality, that's something private. No, I'm going to do it in public, right? And as you can guess, the vast majority of Greeks, and maybe some of you, had a kind of visceral response to it. Please don't do that here. I don't want to see that, right? And here I just want to suggest that there may be people for whom the transformation of the public as our sense of who we are has expanded, has produced a similarly visceral response. And that part of the genius of our current president is to articulate aspects of that visceral response in a way that makes it tangible and relatable to a concrete policy agenda. I think that's the way in which he's playing the immigration card. I think that's the way in which he played the birther card before that. And I want to be clear that what I would say is that we now maybe have two what I will call contra publics in the United States. Two different ways of imagining who you're addressing when you're addressing the public. And both of them, in a sense, exclude the other and threaten to marginalize people who see themselves as publicly empowered in one public and publicly disempowered in another public. And here I would point out that this idea that we the people are sovereign is tied very much to our ability to participate in public discourse, and that in so many ways the experience of modern life in the 21st century is for many of us disempowering, right? We are in control in less and less of our fate. And I'm just going to leave that as an assertion. If you want to question me, I'll be happy to talk about it. But I think many of us are increasingly desperate to feel politically empowered, in part because our sense of control over so many other aspects of our life is eroding. And this is coinciding with a moment in which we are fighting a contest over who belongs in the public and how the public should be conceived and imagined. And this is a very difficult state of affairs, if I'm correct, for democracy to navigate. So let me conclude with a little bit of a constructive idea here. And I want to think about the exemplars of expanded publics. Who is it that successfully got a public to rethink its boundaries, and how did they do that? And I want to start out by pointing out that one of the ideals of public conduct, you might call it of the ethics of citizenship, is that all citizens should be reasonable and respectful, right? That they should find ways of addressing each other in reasons that you believe the other has a good reason to accept, right? That's what it means to show respect to a citizen. That's what we should be aiming for in public discourse. But that's very challenging when you're in a sense saying, we don't believe people like you belong in this public, right? So how have various change agents managed to transform the boundaries of citizenship and reasonableness and inclusion? And here I'm going to go with the usual suspects. I'm going to talk about Mahatma Gandhi, and I'm going to talk about Martin Luther King Jr., and I'm going to talk about Nelson Mandela. And so I'm talking about the tradition of nonviolent action that Gandhi originated and has been passed like a baton to other cases over the last 50, 70 years. And I'm going to suggest that this legacy of nonviolent action has found ways of solving the very difficult problem of how to decenter without marginalizing people in political discourse. If you think everybody who belongs to the public looks and sounds and speaks like me, and all of a sudden there's somebody saying, that's unfair, that's unjust, that's racist, that's sexist, that's homophobic, well, how do you react without seeing your status and your standing as a citizen threatened? And I want to suggest that's not all on the hitherto dominant to do the work of transforming themselves. That the genius of a Gandhi or a King or a Mandela was to be able to show to the currently dominant that they could still be equal citizens in an expanded public. And that in a sense, what we urgently need to do if we're going to do the work of democratic self-repair in our current historical moment is figure out ways of replicating that stance in which we say, we're not going to let you be dominant anymore. That's unfair, unjust, racist, etc. But that doesn't mean that we're going to dominate or marginalize you. And not only that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
We hope, and here's the, I think, the real power of this civil rights tradition thinking, that you will have, in fact, a more secure sense of self-respect if your sense of self does not depend on unjustly excluding us. You will have a more secure affect if your sense of being worthy of respect is not pegged on something arbitrary like race or gender or sexuality, right? And so this is, it seems to me, and I'm still kind of, as you can probably hear, groping to come up with a full model of how this kind of transformative political discourse works. But I think something like this is at stake, and that in a sense, something like this needs to be an aspiration for contemporary American politics if we're going to pull back from the levels of polarization that we have right now. And I'm operating on an assumption. I have a couple relatives here tonight who I suspect are Trump supporters. But having said that, I am definitely trying to talk respectfully to Trump supporters, but I'm also talking to what I suspect is the majority in this room, being in San Francisco, California, that we are mainly not Trump supporters. And I think we have a fine line to walk here. On the one hand, I don't think if you oppose Trump and his agenda that you can simply disarm unilaterally in the name of civility, right? That the issues are too important to not be mobilized. But I also think we have to be extremely cautious about what I will call reciprocal incivility, right? Meeting the other side in a race to be as hostile and as mobilized and as demonizing as possible. That does not do our long-term aim of restoring democracy, repairing its non-responsiveness, any good. And so as opposed to that, I think we need to work on the very dilemmatic work of securing equal citizenship in a climate of polarization, right? In a climate where we don't want to work together and we may not want to concede each other's reasonableness or want to in any way enable the other side. But unless and until we start figuring out how we can model working together, we're not going to be able to restore democratic responsiveness. And I would point out to you that I think a large part of the reason that a significant portion of the American people have turned to Trump and turned against the norms of civility is because, on the one hand, they are frustrated, mad, and anxious with the failure of mainstream, ordinary American politics to address their problems. And on the other hand, they see the people who are imposing the norms of civility on them to be precisely the elite who have monopolized and hoarded all the opportunities that globalization has opened up for us. And so a certain, if not sympathy, at least understanding of the way in which we have some common problems and need to work together to solve them is, I guess, what I am trying to envision in this talk. One last thing I'll leave you with is that if a public is imagined, right, if what it is brought into being through discourse and through the way in which we address each other and the way in which we imagine our addresses circulating, the way in which we think when we hear public talk about who is receiving it, we need to work on imagining and projecting an inclusive, multiracial, non-patriarchal, I'll throw in post-conventional, no single religion uniting it, egalitarian public. And that isn't just getting our way issue by issue. That is figuring out how those with whom we disagree vehemently on political issues can nevertheless be included as equal citizens in our discourse. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we have time for 15 to 20 minutes of questions, and hopefully they'll be brief questions, but maybe long answers.
It seems to me that when you are talking to somebody face-to-face, it is incumbent upon you to be more civil, and it just happens better. Whereas if you are on the internet, it's leading us in the wrong direction. What do you think?
Yeah, not only do I think you're right, I think there's a lot of literature that suggests you're right. And so there are a couple findings that are quite stunning on this. I mean, first, there's anonymity on the web, and there's this whole idea of a troll, right? Somebody who's just out there to rattle your feathers because they have fun doing that. And it's a lot harder to be that kind of bully in person. There's a second finding, and there's social, psychological, and developmental psychological research that's being done that shows that the onset of empathy in young children is being delayed in our society. And the reason is apparently because embodied emotional response is essential to learning empathy. It's one thing for somebody to put an emoji on their phone of a crying face when you've upset them. It's another thing to watch them flush and tear up and gasp, right? And we learn a lot more from that embodied emotional response. Third thing, and this then brings us into the realm that I'm talking about, learning about what social psychologists and philosophers call alterity, the difference of the other, right? That the other person is not a mirror image of you, is required in order to participate in conversation. That's really what conversation is. It's an exploration of the other through discourse, and that requires that one practice in engaging across lines of difference that works much better face-to-face. Bill did warn you I'd give long answers. Fourth point, and that is that our media environment has become much more segmented as a result of digital technology. I watch the people who agree with me. You watch the people who agree with you. We're in our silos. We're constructing hermetically sealed realities for ourselves. And it gets to the point where we can't even agree on the nature of reality. So, yes, I think in all of these respects, and World Enough and Time, that would be part of what I would talk about today. But it is definitely part of what's going on with the decline of civil discourse in our society. Yes, thank you for the good question. Hi.
Hi. So my question, if we look at broadening the scope of what the public is and being more inclusive, I think we see younger generations are really embodying that idea. But how do you reconcile that mentality with the advent of what we call safe spaces, where we're limiting discourse and trying not to, you know, use trigger words and all of these things? How do you reconcile that as being maybe too exclusive of those things and separating the public even more?
Yeah, so I haven't thought that one through. Let me try. I teach at a college, and I occasionally do give trigger warnings. So for those of you, is this making sense to everyone, right? That is to say, if you're studying a novel that has a scene of sexual predation or aggression in it, you warn your students in advance that this is going to happen in case any of them have been victims of sexual harassment and they might be re-traumatized by the literature. Or alternatively, you try to construct a space on a campus where there will be no hate speech because hate speech silences people, shuts people down. It undermines civil discourse. And as you are hearing, I believe in norms of civility, right? But I also believe in freedom of speech. And so, again, there's a balancing that has to occur. Now, ultimately, we have to be in a place in which we are able to talk across our differences, right? But I guess part of what I'm suggesting is that that is not something that occurs naturally, but has to be cultivated or curated, if you will. And so it may be that we need safe spaces to do some of this work. If you look at feminism, you look at the moment in the history of feminism that was a moment of consciousness raising in which women were primarily talking among themselves. They needed to do that first, which in a sense was a private or at least not a fully public mode of communication before gaining the articulacy about their experiences and the conviction, the sense of commonality to bring these concerns into the public. Being touched regularly at work is not just a private matter. It is a matter of public concern, right? It takes us a while to get there. So maybe safe spaces have a role to be played or do play an important role in our society. But I do have to say, I think that the sensitivity and the flip side of this is the righteousness, right, that sometimes accompanies this can go too far. And you understand why it's going too far at the current moment. I've been talking about the hitherto dominant. We can also talk about the hitherto excluded, right? The hitherto excluded, the people who have been marginal to the public up until this moment are saying, damn it, that's enough, and we're going to come into the public, and we're going to demand that you recognize us as full citizens. Sometimes you overshoot the mark in that moment, and sometimes you may have to correct. And I guess, in a sense, one way of talking, lending some vocabulary to what it is I'm saying today, is to talk for a moment about the distinction between recognition and respect. This is a moral philosophical dispute between Kant, who's a theorist of respect, and Hegel, who's a theorist of recognition. Recognition says, I, in my particular identity, demand that you value me, right? And kids do this to parents all the time. Right. You know, it's part of the difficulty of growing up is getting your parent to treat you not in the way they view you, but in the way you view yourself. Respect, on the other hand, is saying I have general attributes as a person that everybody should acknowledge. Right. The way I've set this up, recognition is important for your significant others. Respect is what you afford to everyone as a human being or a fellow citizen. We've been in a moment of the politics of recognition in which people have demanded, who have been publicly disvalued, that their identities be publicly positively valued. I think, frankly, this has given rise to white identity politics. It's a kind of reciprocal movement, right? You know, if you can demand as a black person or a woman or a homosexual that I value your identity, why can't I demand that you value me as a white person? I think we may have gone a little bit far in this direction, and that college campuses may be one place where we do overshoot the mark on a somewhat regular basis. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm
David,
trying to find the mic.
I've taken a number of your great courses at the Fromm, as you know, and Osher, SF State, and always astounded by your brilliance and ability to communicate. Maybe I'm too optimistic, but I would like you to, A, list what actually is defunctional, like bullet points, about our democracy, and compared to the 1960s, when it was coming out of the theme, we were in pretty damn good shape. And secondly, would you be talking like this if Hillary Clinton, or better yet, Bernie Sanders was president?
Yeah, so two different questions. And I'm not going to give a whole lecture on what's dysfunctional about our democracy, but maybe I can take you back to these three labels that I used at the very beginning. Where am I? I see what I did. Okay, let's see if I can. I could use all of these slides, how unequal we are as a society, et cetera. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, let's see. I'm trying to get back to, there we are. Good. Scotchpole, Theda Scotchpole, writes a book in 2003 about the decline of civil society institutions. There was a period in American history when there were more club members than there were people in our society, right? What does that mean? That means people were joining more than one club, and they were coming together cross classes. And this was a critical institution for building public opinion. And it was federated in its structure, local. And so I guess, you know, you are here at the Commonwealth Club. You participate in at least one civil organization. You are quite exceptional relative to most Americans today. So that would be one example. Then I say further down the road is disfigured democracy, right? This is Nadia Urbanati's work published in 2014. And there she's talking about the sense that in a democracy, we only feel politically empowered to the extent that we have an equal opportunity to influence public opinion formation. And I guess I'll just ask you, how many of you feel like you have an equal opportunity to influence the formation of public opinion in the United States today? Right? And that's pretty striking, right? I mean, I it was a rhetorical question, but I'm not seeing any hands come up, right?
By
your vote. But the vote is a highly attenuated mechanism via which to influence public opinion formation. We do it once every 2 years, and we do it usually for only two candidates, and we do it in California. We almost always know who's going to win in advance, right? And so there needs to be more for public opinion to be meaningfully available, malleable, something that citizens feel that they have some control over. And coming back to this question, I do think it has a lot to do with the media environment in our country and the extent to which there's a disconnect between the ownership and the structure of most of the mainstream media and the rest of us. I could go on and on about what's been happening to small newspapers in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think many of you know the story that they were purchased by a hedge fund in order to extract resources in order to invest in Greek debt, right? It's not a pretty story. And the result is that there are fewer and fewer and fewer reporters. And the result is, what do we do to influence public opinion? We write letters to the editor, but fewer people are reading those newspapers. We engage in protests, but there are fewer reporters to cover those protests. We go to meetings, and we seek to get what happens at the meeting publicized, but there's less and less reportage occurring. So that would be a second example of the way in which democracy is dysfunctional. Third, Levitsky and Zablatt indicate that the norms that have led to bipartisan cooperation, which our institutions require, have been eroded dramatically over the last 40 years of partisan polarization. Let me just say one more thing here, and here I will go beyond everything that I've shown you so far. This is a diagram of responsiveness on the part of senators from 2000 to 2010, showing low-income, middle-income, and high-income people. You are seeing that correctly. There's actually negative responsiveness in some of those periods for low- and middle-income people. The only group for whom there is genuine responsiveness is high-income people. This is another way of measuring this. A flat line means no responsiveness. Average citizens' preferences have no impact on the way in which our representatives decide political issues. Economic elites and interest groups have a great deal of impact. All of that seems to me to suggest that we're in a period of dysfunctional democracy. And everything I've been talking about so far is process. Let me say one more thing here. We're as unequal in terms of income and wealth as we have been at any point since the Gilded Age, right? So in the last 100 years. And we just passed a tax reform bill that looks like it's going to exacerbate that as opposed to address that. And so it's not just that our politics is non-responsive, that we don't have agency over our public discourse. It's that policy is adrift. It's not responding to 21st century problems. And so those are all the reasons why I would say democracy is dysfunctional. Could it be worse? Of course it could be worse. The point is not, you know, are we as bad as we could be, but are we capable of repairing what's wrong with democracy in our current historical moment? And that's really what I'm trying to address. So that was your first question. What was the second question?
Would you be talking like this?
I'm sorry. If would I be talking like this if Sanders or Clinton were president? And let me just say this. I think we should have been talking like this when Obama was president. And here's, I think, part of the way to put this. When I'm going to talk to the liberals and the progressives in the room for a moment, apologies to others. But when we liberals and progressives see the children of immigrants being separated from their parents, we are understandably outraged and mobilized, and we fly into action, right? When we see jobs shipped overseas and people who are in the white working class in the middle of this country losing their economic viability and their expectations shattered, are we similarly outraged? And if we're not, then are we not contributing to the sense that the coastal elite has its agenda about race and immigration and sexuality, but not a similar concern for the suffering of other people? And in fact, we're asking them to join us in these campaigns or demonizing them if they don't. And so, look, I think that Obama wanted to do a lot that would have helped the people I'm talking about right now, and that in many ways he was obstructed from doing that by the other party in many respects. Having said that, where was the outrage? Where was the animation? Where was the protest that might have built a broader coalition? So I do want to say, yes, I don't know, but I hope I would be giving a similar talk even if Bernie Sanders were president. Yes, please.
Yes, you talk about polarization and the dismissal of the people who have been suffering under the economic expansion. But I want to ask you how much, if you've considered how much of that is deliberate polarization by people who are essentially inimical to democracy and are using that as a way of maintaining power, in the sense that they are less concerned with the politics that they have than what particular politics will get them and keep them in power.
Yes, so I think I understand, And so let me just very briefly point out to you that both Steve Miller and Bannon have said explicitly that they like it when Democrats and progressives call Trump a racist, right? Because that actually mobilizes their base. And there's a lot of politics of racial resentment in this country right now. And this is part of what's fracturing our public sphere and leading to all this incivility. Increasingly, white people want to say, and obviously not all white people, but a significant portion of white people, we can be anti-immigrant without being racist, right? And why are you tarring us with that brush? And I think in a sense, part of what Trump is doing is baiting the progressive left into making that highly incendiary charge because he knows it will mobilize his base. Now, that's not quite the same thing as what you're saying. I think what you're saying is that a kind of divide and conquer politics produces policy stasis, paralysis of our government, and that when our government is paralyzed, that's good for vested interests who don't want to be regulated, right? And I do think there's a fair bit of that going on as well. And there's a lot of literature documenting the way in which a lot of money has gone into think tanks and policy initiatives, the Tea Party, et cetera, precisely for this reason. So, yes, I do agree with all of that. Having said all of that, what I've tried to do today is broaden the perspective and to talk not just about kind of the competition between the two political parties in which we are primarily spectators and our role is primarily to vote. That's not democratic mobilization. That's not how democracy is repaired when it needs repair. When we change the rules of the game, the terms of political discourse, it's because the public mobilizes independently from and often against the party elite. And in a sense, that's part of what needs to happen right now to reset the rules of the game precisely because they are so tilted right now. I'm sorry, I've got to go where the microphone is. Yeah,
yeah, the microphone owner has the floor. I have 10 million questions, but I boil it down to 1.5 for you. The first is, who is listening to your message? So who do you see resonating with this message right now? I would observe the demographics of the audience today.
And yeah.
Presumably there's a selection bias associated with who you generally speak to. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear where you see the message resonating. And the second half of that is you observed you're speaking to a San Francisco audience. And obviously you speak also to a New York audience.
Right.
Have you had the opportunity to speak to a right-leaning audience? And do you see a difference in how in the reaction across the ideological spectrum?
Sure. So I'll start with the second question very quickly. One of the things that I do some scholarship on, and some people here have taken courses with me on, is religion in politics. And every now and then, I think I get confused for a conservative and invited to a conference to talk about these themes because I actually write quite sympathetically about the need to accommodate religious contributions to the public spheres. I think in a sense, it's an experience everyone should have. Well, you know, the old model of this is to be the only white person in a room that has all black people in it, right? You know, that's an experience too few of us probably have. It's an experience, in a sense, all of us should have if we want to have a little bit of sympathy for the experience of racial marginalization. Similarly, and by the way, I didn't share this with you. I've got more slides and more stuff than I know what to do with. But look at this. Who actually encounters political difference on a regular basis, right? It's a little small, but it's the people with the least knowledge and the least interest have the highest levels of cross-partisan encounters. The people with the most knowledge and most interest have the least encounters. Similarly, the people with the least income have the most encounters, and the people with the least education have the most encounters. White people have fewer encounters with difference. And this is in part because of where these encounters work. And this is a crappy chart, but what this shows is that almost all cross-partisan encounters occur in work and work alone, right? And that, frankly, those of us who are affluent and well-educated and liberal get to work in places where we're surrounded by people like us. So you're definitely on to something there. And yes, I am talking in a sense to my peeps right now, right? And I know that. And in a sense, what I am trying to say is, while we shouldn't unilaterally disarm, we should do a lot more to try to hear the other side, to find our commonalities, to try to sympathetically understand as opposed to anthropologically analyze where people who we view as uncivil and backward and pursuing unjust policies are coming from, and how we can do bridge work to be able to work with them and in so doing show them that maybe we're not as frightening and as elite and as committed to hoarding our goods as maybe they think we are. That would involve perhaps changing us as much as changing them. So yes. Who nods? I'll say one last thing to this question. I am a political philosopher, and political philosophers tend to write to 50 years to 100 years in the future. and so I'm not sure who's nodding their head, and I'm not, in a sense, necessarily trying to get head nods right now. Changing culture, changing ideas, changing normative self-understandings, that's hard. What do they call that? The slow boring of hard boards, right? It takes a long time, and so I'm not trying to get immediate assent. All right, sorry, I didn't see you. Go ahead.
It's on.
Okay, oh. Good.
How do you deal with something where there is no obvious answer? I'm thinking particularly of abortion, between the people who truly believe that the soul enters the body at conception and those who do not.
Yes, yeah, so this is a challenge for the idea of the reasonable, right? The reasonable is finding reasons that others can be expected to accept, to not view as simply in and of themselves disrespectful of them. And so this goes two ways. I mean, I think on the one hand, you have to be able to say to the religious who believe in ensoulment at the moment of conception that unless you've got a non-metaphysical or theological way of defending that, you cannot expect me to be persuaded by that. And that doesn't mean that I don't accept the legitimacy of your believing that, but it does mean that it would be unfair for you to change our coercively enforced law solely on the basis of your religious conviction. That's sectarianism, right? And we've got a lot of distance from having had a sectarian state. But conversely, I have to acknowledge that I'm not going to persuade them that abortion isn't murder, and that the fact that they consider something to be murder on religious grounds is sufficient reason for them to oppose the policy I favor, right? And so we've got to think about compromise. We've got to think about how we can respect each other on issues that we're not going to agree on. Now you've put your finger on probably the most difficult and intractable of these issues. The good news is, as I've tried to show you with a little bit of opinion research, we're actually on many more policy issues much closer together than our highly polarized partisan identity environment leads us to believe. And so part of the trick is to maybe say, well, first let's figure out what we can work on together, and then maybe it'll be a little bit less hard for us to think about some of these culture war issues once we've established that there are things we can work on together. Yes, please. Hi.
You referenced the idea of influencing public opinion in reference to our vote. But what is the role of Citizens United, and
sure,
where will that lead us, or its sustainability and or its change?
I've got a slide for everything. Overall spending on federal elections and lobbying has soared, right? If you can see that, it's about tripled over the last 15 years. If you look at where that money comes from, do you see that? 1% of the population, actually 0.26% of the population, funded 68% of our congressional races, right? And so when you go back to why it is the average citizen's preference doesn't have any influence, but the economic elites do, you can immediately see why that is. Now, having said that, right, the Citizens United and the whole string of decisions in which Citizens United is a pivot is part of the reason that this is happening. But this data precedes Citizens United. So we've got a broader problem here, and that problem is money in politics. And that is not just about the regulation of campaign finance, so that's extremely important. It's about the way in which we structure our elections as well. They go on forever, and they allow for this constant expenditure. Right. And so this is a big problem. This is part of the problem of democratic self-repair. Right. This is the stuff that I want us to be able to start talking about. We want more accountable and responsive decisions from our politicians. We want them to be solving not the 1% problems, but the rest of our problems. How do we get there? We need to, it's a chicken and egg problem, restore responsiveness in our institutions to be able to begin to solve these problems. And so in a sense, unless and until we the people can conceive of ourselves as a single people and begin to work together on these issues, my suggestion is that we're not going to be able to solve things like campaign finance reform. Now, having said all of that, I'm talking in these very abstract terms. We are likely to about to have a new member of the Supreme Court confirmed, and that person seems highly unlikely to want to overturn Citizens United. We've got a lot of work to do to get this done. I think there is a long history in the United States of popular constitutional politics, the people changing the way in which the court interprets the Constitution. At some point, data like this has to become the basis for popular mobilization that says to the Supreme Court, your definition of corruption is far too narrow. A political process in which 90% of the population have no influence over outcomes is corrupt, even if nobody is handing a bag of money behind the scenes to somebody for their vote, right? And so this is part of what I'm trying to talk about, but you're absolutely right. This is an incredibly complex problem. It has multifaceted dimensions. I'm trying, in a sense, to talk to the meta problem. How do we get our political agency back so we can begin solving problem by problem all of the things that's making democracy dysfunctional in 21st century America? Go ahead.
Thank you. Coming back to a question that was raised earlier around like social media echo chambers. So intuitively, we think that by being surrounded by similar beliefs, that's negative and polarizing. But there's some research that shows like exposure to other people's beliefs, opinions, statuses, and even media on the other side doesn't actually help the already polarized become less polarized. It further polarizes them because you can just demonize the other party, which is concerning because if you think that exposure to the other side is actually going to bring people closer together, it doesn't always have that impact. What evidence or like historical precedent do you see for public discourse being different than just exposure to media or opinion on the other side?
Yeah.
And being able to like depolarize?
Yeah, good, great question. Really interesting question. Thank you. And so let me start by saying two things. The first is that almost all of the studies I see focus on direct interpersonal interaction. And I've already said that that's very important, but I also want to say in a sense it's atypical or unusual for democratic discourse, that most democratic discourse is mediated. And so I think a healthy public sphere has both. It has some face-to-face interaction between people who are of dissimilar views, but it also has a vital public sphere in which we're able to encounter different perspectives by reading our newspaper or watching our TV or opening our phones, right? And so you need both, and we shouldn't just prioritize face-to-face, and a lot of this research definitely focuses on face-to-face stuff. Second thing, remember that chart from Diana Munt's work where she shows that you learn about the other side only if you already have a civil orientation to conflict. And if you don't have a civil orientation to conflict, then you end up basically, and I didn't reproduce this data, but you're absolutely right, reinforcing your own perspective as opposed to opening yourself to the other side. And so part of the question here, and I've referred to this as an ethics of citizenship, is how do we cultivate an orientation to conflict that is civil, that is open, that leads us to learn? One of my heroes here is John Stuart Mill, and John Stuart Mill talks about corrigibility, which is a fancy word for correctability, right? You know, we should each recognize that we don't have a monopoly on the truth, that we actually benefit from hearing those who disagree with us, not only because that's what it means to be civil and engaged in a diverse public, but because, well, they may actually know something we don't know. They may have perceived something that we're neglecting. Their perspective may help us to have a fuller understanding. And even if I don't change my mind, the fact that I may have had to compromise with them may lead us to embrace a better policy, right? And so how do we get back to that place where at least we're recognizing the legitimacy of the other side, but even better, that we do better politically when we harness and use diversity and conflict to solve problems. That requires civility, and that's what's in danger. So you're absolutely right that being exposed to the other side does not guarantee that you'll learn, and that our media environment is maybe doing some of us a favor every now and then by insulating us, but I think dominantly it's not. And so it can't just be, you know, that the MSNBC watcher flips to Fox every now and then and vice versa, right? It's got to be that our schools and our clubs and our public culture prepare us to deal with difference constructively, political difference constructively. Yeah.
It's been a very interesting conversation. We've got time for one more question.
All right, good. Thanks again, Pam.
Oh, boy. I have been perplexed for most of my life by the attitude towards activism and how many people in our society take this aspect of public agency as, you know, they kind of talk about it. Extramarital sex. I've never done this before. I just want you all to know that this is something I wouldn't ordinarily do, but I'm just coming out now. And I don't understand it. I have found
I mean, I understand people not wanting to go out in the street because they're afraid that violence is going to take place or something. But it seems to be more than that to me as someone who has spent a lot of time in the streets and believes that's where a lot happens that is very positive. And I don't know where this fits in. We've talked about talking to each other, but what about acting with each other?
Good. And so I'll say two things. Of course, engaging in public protest is one of the main ways in which social mobilization occurs and one of the main ways in which people aim to influence public opinion. However, I will also say, and again, topic for another day, really, that in the era of social media viral activism, right, in which what we're doing is not spending a decade building an organization from the grassroots up, but simply putting something on a Facebook page and 100,000 people turn up, two things are happening. The first is that this is ephemeral, that this is not really building the infrastructure of mobilization. And the second thing is that it's almost always a gathering of the like-minded who reinforce the sense of righteous indignation often that leads people into the streets in the first place. And there's an important moment for that. It does actually help to produce courage and energy and commitment and get people into the voting booth. But having said that, it's not a substitute for civil discourse. And so one of the things that I think is worrisome here is when you look at what the NAACP did over the course of the majority of the 20th century in order to build an infrastructure of organization, in order to litigate cases, in order to community by community bring visibility to the often invisible injuries that people in a segregated climate were suffering. That's real work of reaching out to people who differ from you. And I worry that in this moment, our activism is not doing enough of that work. And so we may need to rethink not activism itself, but how to structure activism so that it contributes to organization, long-term mobilization, inclusiveness, and persuading the other side, not just mobilizing our side.
I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum. We thank David Peretz for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you, Bill.